in your notes of the book of Nehemiah. Okay. Yeah, that's last week's. Let me get rid of this page for you. There you go. And there, that's last week's. There you go. Because it
you said you're on 17. Okay.
Now you have today's notes as well?
Yes, sir.
Okay. We're going to try to cover more territory. Now what I've done in these notes is I've written, you weren't here, I wrote an introduction to it, talked about some of the main themes, and on page 15, if you have your 15 in your notes there, you see I've written a summary of chapter 2. And I write a summary for each chapter, and then we go through the details of the chapter. Okay? But we are now on 2C. 1C was King Nehemiah grants Nehemiah permission to go to Jerusalem and rebuild the walls. And the second section of this chapter is 2C on the bottom of page 17, where Nehemiah travels to Jerusalem and personally investigates the situation. And here we see him going to conform the reports and make his own evaluation. In our summary, we said last week that a leader always looks for options. He takes input from others. A man that doesn't examine all of his options is a man that's probably going to make a mistake. You need to examine all of your options and evaluate them. You need advisors. And there's wisdom in many counselors, but the leader makes his own decision. He has to be independent that way. And as I said last week, when anything goes well, the leader gives the credit to others. When things go wrong, the leader assumes responsibility. Right, Colonel? The leader assumes responsibility. So the leader never gets any credit for anything, but he gets blamed a lot, which is why everyone wants to be a leader. But that's the way it is. And so he's going to examine the walls for himself to verify what he was told is true and to be able to visualize what he has to do. So 2C, Nehemiah travels to Jerusalem and personally investigates a situation. 1D, the text reads, "Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters." So Nehemiah presents his authorization papers to rulers beyond the sea. These papers are important because we're going to see when we get to chapter 4, all progress faces opposition. The minute you change something, you've got some people that are for the change and some that are against it. Change does that. And not all changes are good, and not all changes are bad. So a leader has to be very careful when he makes the changes, and that he has to assume responsibility. Now, 2D, you have a parenthetical statement that Nehemiah travels with military protection to Jerusalem, which of course is evidence of the king's approval. The text reads, "Now the king had sent me with officers of the army and horsemen." Now, Ezra didn't have any. When Ezra went, he turned down the offer to have military protection. We didn't need it. So with the 5,000 that returned under Ezra didn't have it. But Nehemiah's returning alone, and he's got all these goods that he's going to be bringing with him, and he's going to be changing Persian policy because they're going to start rebuilding, and the people in the area aren't going to like it. Now, this opposition, which we saw briefly last week, and we'll see again at verse 19, may very well have been, we're not sure about it, part of it is anti-Semitism, but another part of it could very well be economic. Jerusalem is on one of the main routes, travel routes, and a prosperous Jerusalem means the economy of everybody else is going to suffer a little bit. So there's a little economic rivalry here. And so we're going to see opposition when it comes, and it's going to completely surround him. But we're going to see he's got these military guards. 3D, Nehemiah's presence immediately upsets certain historical, influential, and political enemies of Israel. People threatened by this change. There are some people that do not like any change to the status quo. Okay? The text reads, when Sanballat the Horonite, he's in Samaria up north, and Tobiah the Ammonite, that would be east of Jerusalem across the Dead Sea, servant heard this, it displeased them greatly. Notice, not only it displeased them greatly. That someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel, which sounds a little bit anti-Semitic, doesn't it? And that's still the case. Still the case. 4D. Nehemiah waits 3 days before beginning his investigation. So I was in Jerusalem and was there 3 days, probably for rest, settling in, meeting people, distributing, finding where he's going to store all the stuff that's going to be brought to them. And 5D, Nehemiah secretly inspects Jerusalem's walls at night and begins to have a plan of action. So he's going to seek confirmation of information and to make up his own mind. Chapter 2, verses 12 through 16. So let's go with him on this tour, which is 1 through 6E. 1E, then I arose in the night. So Nehemiah inspects the condition of the walls at night. Leaders often work when everyone else is asleep. Right, David? That's the way it is. That's the way it is. Yeah. Now, I do that in the morning. As you probably know, I go to bed early. Well, the other morning I was up, it's 3:30. And I get stuff done. I get stuff done. So by 10 o'clock, it's noon for me. Or something like that. But I am able to work. Now, when I was in college, it was just the opposite. I was a night owl. But the older I get, I'm now a morning dove. So he goes at night. Leaders spend more time. Yeah. 2E. Nehemiah takes only a few men with him on his inspection. I and a few men with me, probably to avoid suspicion. And 3E, Nehemiah keeps secret the plan of action that God had put in his heart. And I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. He doesn't disclose prematurely what he's going to do. And you have to be careful because people will argue with you. I found this. If you disclose the plan too early to certain people, you'll never get anywhere. They'll argue over the plan, and you want them to argue over the execution, not the plan itself. 4E, he travels lightly. There was no animal with me but the one on which I rode. So he's traveling lightly. 5E, Nehemiah personally inspects the damage as far as he could. Now, let's read the text and then let's look at the map that I... Oh, you don't have... When I did the introduction, I handed out maps and all sorts of stuff. I'm sorry about that. I went out at night by the valley gate to the dragon gate and to the dung gate, and I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the night by the valley and inspected the wall and turned back and entered by the valley gate and so returned. Now, if you turn in your maps that you had a couple weeks ago that I gave you, there was one map of the city and another map of the post-exilic Samaria and so forth, timelines and charts and all sorts of stuff. For those of you who have that, do you have that Jerusalem in the time? That's the one. That's the one. Jerusalem in the time of Nehemiah. Do you see that map there? Now go down to that little part that extends there, that little part. See the valley gate down at the very bottom, towards the bottom? Well, actually, at the bottom, you've got the dung gate, and you go back up, and you see the valley gate. Do you see it, Miss Nelda? There's the valley gate. Okay. He goes out of that gate. He turns south. He goes down to the dung gate. Why do they call it the dung gate? Anyone want to guess? No, that's where they take all the dung and refuse. Because right below that is the valley of Hinnom, where they burn the refuse, where the worm dieth not, neither is the fire quenched. And that is where all the refuse is, and it becomes a picture for hell. It becomes a picture for Gehenna, Valley of Hinnom. It goes down there, then it turns, goes to the fountain gate, and you see he gets somewhere up in there when he can't go any further. So you see from our reading of the text just how far he's gone. He hasn't been able to inspect the whole wall, just the southern part. And the damage on the east side is so bad he can't go any further. But he does make an effort. The key to remember is he does make an effort to see this for himself. 6E, back on page 18. Nehemiah keeps secret what he has done until the proper time. And this repeats chapter 2, verse 12 for emphasis. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing. And I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. He holds it into his hand, doesn't prematurely reveal it. He's still thinking this thing through. Very important. Timing, timing, timing is everything. There are all, in many a situation in churches, I have prayed for a change long before I informed anyone about the change that needed to be made. You have to prepare the ground ahead of time with a lot of prayer. And we saw that in Nehemiah 1 with a great prayer. Now, 3C, on top of page 19, Nehemiah identifies himself with the people as he publicly challenges them to repair the walls. Now he's going to reveal what's on his heart. 1D, Nehemiah reminds the people of their perilous condition. Then I said to them, "You see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned." Do you think they already knew that? Yeah. So why does he state the obvious? One of the most important things a leader has to do is to define reality for the people. He has to define reality. He is telling them, we're in a tight fix here. I think I may have told you a story from my dear friend Dan Hooten. He was vice president in a number of companies, Land of Lakes being one of them up in Minnesota. He found out the president, T.J. Barlow, had called in all the vice presidents. The company was being sued for $15 million. So he got all the vice presidents in, and he said to them, we've got a problem here. We're being sued for $15 million. Let's start on the left and work our way around and see what everyone's thinking about this problem. Well, Dan said, by the time it had made its way all the way around the circle and back to the president of the company, the vice presidents had concluded that really there wasn't much of a problem. And the president had to say, gentlemen, we are being sued for $15 million. We have a problem. So let's start all over again. See? And that's why to this day, Dan, who's now 96, has the highest respect for T.J. Barlow. Barlow was able to put his finger on what the problem was. He told me another time he overheard Barlow in the hallway talk to the lawyer of the corporation. Apparently, the lawyer had been goofing around, and T.J. Barlow came in and just, David, you're going to love this, just asked one question and leaves. Doesn't lecture, doesn't do anything. Just went and, he said, are we still building our plant on other people's land? Boy, I tell you, that lawyer certainly made sure that just the importance of asking a question is taught there. You don't have to rebuke, just a question, a well-phrased question. Leaders define problems. That's the first step. They have a problem. They, by the way, these people have gotten accustomed to this mess. I have been in dirty homes as a pastor where they don't have a filing system, they've got a piling system. Have you met people like that? And I met with one lady in the church that had 19 cats in the house. That was probably the shortest pastoral visit I've ever made. We got out in the car because I took an elder with me. And he said to me, how can she live in that mess? I said, she's used to it. She doesn't see it. Do you know that you can remove furniture from your front room without ever touching it or having anybody else touch it? How do you remove furniture or put furniture in your room? By being aware of it. When you take the room for granted, you don't see. You know, I have in my office some lovely pictures on the wall, but many times when I'm in there, I'm totally oblivious that they're there because I'm not thinking about them. Being aware of your furniture either puts furniture in your room or takes it out, and you have to be aware of it. And that's one of the things the leader has to do. He has to define exactly what the problem is. Now you're going to find in chapter 4 that they don't understand the problem. They have lived with this mess for a long time. By the way, I'm going to say something that I don't mean to insult, but I want to instruct. Your biggest problems in life, spiritually speaking, are sins that you've committed over and over and over again. You've gotten used to them. Oh, well, that's me. If you want to make an advance in your spiritual life, you have to define reality. You have to say, I have a problem. And I keep doing it. Because once you keep committing a sin, it becomes normal. And once things are normal, they are acceptable. And you and I have to be very careful about that, of what we allow ourselves to get accustomed to. We have to be very careful about that. Now, you know, sometimes this is one advantage that I have that others don't have. I live with the Holy Spirit's agent on earth. Do you have one, Dan? Wait a second. Whoa. You know, and. I all of us have blind spots, and that's why we need someone who we are convinced loves us. And the method and their manner and their motive is to help us. All criticism really is destructive, but it can become constructive if it's given to us in a loving manner and we're willing to receive it. And that's hard. Because you see, we get so used to the way we act, it becomes normal. Once it becomes normal, it becomes acceptable. So I know people say, oh, you're all the time preaching about sin. Sin, sin, sin. That's right. Because we live in a world that's completely surrounded by it. I think that Jesus Christ, when he was on the cross, suffered something that he had never suffered before. He became very, very much aware of the sinfulness of sin because he'd never experienced it before. He who knew no sin became a sin offering for us. You and I are so used to living in sin, we don't are fazed by it. Oh, we're fazed by other people's sins. Oh, yeah. Well, their sins bother us. But you know why their sins bother us? Have you ever heard of the psychological term called projection? You have, Patty? Did I see? The sins that really bug you, really, really get under your skin in those around you that you love. Psychologists say you identify secretly that you have that problem. And since you don't want to get mad at yourself, it's easier to get mad at them. Some say Jesus had this in mind when he said, "Judge not, lest ye be judged. For the same measure you measure to others, it shall be measured to you." So when I see a sin in somebody else, one of the things I like to ask myself, if I'm wise at the time, is say, why is that bothering me? Is there something in me that I'd like to say, well, it's because I'm so holy, but perhaps it isn't. So you and I have to be very careful about that. And we have to be aware of sin. Now, not paranoid about it, but we have to be aware that we don't take our sins for granted. Oh, this is just how we do things. This is the way things are done. It takes some sensitivity. Okay, let's go on to 2D. Nehemiah challenges the people. The text says, "Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision." So he challenges the people to work. By the way, I want to show, you know what one of the key words in that sentence are? There's one in the first clause, it's two letters. There's one in the second clause, two letters. The second clause begins with that, which introduces a purpose clause. Do you know what they are? Us and we. What is Nehemiah doing with this us and we? I can't hear. Were you speaking, Patty?
Putting them together.
Well, putting what together, Patty?
Us and we. There's no separation. They're all one unit.
They're all in a group. It's not you.
No.
You need to get to work. Yeah, you need to get to work. We. I'm in this with you. See? That's key. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. I'm in this with you. I'm going to help you all I can. Yeah. That's the way it is. Yeah. We are funny. I think I may have said this to you before. we criticize others for what they do. We defend ourselves by what we mean. You said that. Now, when that is said to us, we say, yes, but I meant. Do you see how that goes? We attack others for what they do. We defend ourselves by what we mean, our motivation. He doesn't get into that kind of dichotomy. He says, together we're in this thing. When I start preaching about sin, I have to say, we sinners. Hazards. One of the hazards that preachers can very easily fall into, professional hazard, is that they get a power, a drive, a power surge as they denounce the sins of others. I can assure you, when I was younger, I went on many a power surge. I was loving to tell everybody how the cow ate the cabbage and what was wrong with the older generation. By the way, I wasn't wrong in my analysis, but boy, did I sin in how I did it. There was this power. I just felt so, man, the righteous indignation rose up in me. And by the way, when you see these political people out there, notice how angry they are. They're on a power surge. They're on a power surge. Anger does strange things to us. And so we have to be careful when we start denouncing the sins of others, that we don't feel that, you know, a bit of self-righteousness. It was said about some of the Pharisees that they were never so happy as when they had a false prophet they could persecute. You have to be very careful. Now, I'm not saying that you never say, I'm sorry, but this is a sin. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying what Paul says in Galatians, let us with meekness, teachableness, you know. Other people's sins can teach us a lot about ourselves. And sometimes it's not flattering. Okay. 3D, he now moves on from exhortation to the reason. Nehemiah reveals how God has blessed his efforts. This is what separates a critic from a leader. He comes up with a workable solution. And I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also the words of the king that had spoken to me. Dale Carnegie said in his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, any fool can argue, and most fools do. It is easy to see flaws in other people. I don't know how many times people have come up to me and said, you know what's wrong with this church? Oh, tell me, I'd love to know. And they'd tell me just exactly what the problem is. And I said, well, that's interesting. How do you propose we solve it? Well, that's your job. Thank you. Any fool can criticize. A leader has to say we have a workable solution. Not just a solution, but a workable one. And that's what he does here. God is working on me, and we've got the king's support. 4D, people respond positively to Nehemiah's challenge. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hand for the good work. He's been very successful. 19 and 20, the last part, Nehemiah faces immediate opposition from influential foreign leaders. Obedience to God often arouses opposition. The influential and powerful leaders, 1D, oppose Nehemiah's efforts with mockery. Remember Psalm 2, 1 and 2. The world does not want to be ruled by God, period. They do not want God to be honored. But when Sanballat the Horonite, that is Samaria on the north of Jerusalem, Tobiah the Ammonite, that's western, Geshem the Arab heard of it, now that's south, they jeered at us and despised us and said, "What is this thing you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" I want you to notice that Sanballat, who's up in the north, and Tobiah, Ammonite, and Geshem, Arab, is three sides of Jerusalem. When we get to chapter 4, we're going to add Ashdod, which is to the west. So they're completely surrounded all the way around, north, south, east, and west. Jerusalem is isolated. But notice what he does here. Nehemiah responds in 2D. He responds decisively to this opposition. Positively, he says, "Then I replied to them, 'The God of heaven will make us prosper, and we, his servants, will arise and build.'" So he says right away, we've got God's blessing. And then negatively, "You have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem." He refuses to compromise God's work with unbelievers. And there's two passages you could look at, Ezra 4 and 2 Corinthians 6, that emphasizes. That ends the second chapter. I want to take just a few minutes to do the summary of chapter 3. Now, those of you who've read Nehemiah chapter 3, now, Glenda wasn't here this morning. She told me last week, I started reading Nehemiah and got as far as chapter 3 with all these names. And she said, it kind of discouraged. It's like Leviticus, you know? Get that far. So turn on page 20, and here is, now I'm going to confess something. I'm rather pleased with this summary. I am pleased with it because when I first read chapter 3, I didn't think I had anything to write. Because all it is listing names of people who work on this gate, then the people who work on that gate, then the people who work on this gate, and the people who work on this gate, and the people who work on this gate, and the people who work on this gate. And you say, what are you going to do with that? This is a passage no one's going to preach. This is, when you preach through Nehemiah, you skip through chapter 3. So this summary here, I don't mind telling you, took hours. I mean ours. Summary of chapter 3. Preparation moves to execution. Delegation and administration as the actual rebuilding project begins. Having declared that the God of heaven will make them prosper, verse 20 of the last chapter, the work on the walls begins in a systematic manner to prove their claim. Here the reader sees Nehemiah's administrative gifts bringing order and unity to a vast, physically far spread project with a widely diverse group of people. Here is the acid test for Nehemiah's plans. Poor execution will cause the greatest of plans to fail, right? Execution is key. Where am I? Thus, Nehemiah must not only plan the what, the task, but the how, the method of execution. Colonel, a leader thinks strategically and logistically. I hope I got those right. A further complication in execution may also arise when there is an unexpected change in the situation. This may require a mid-course corrections that will test the flexibility of a leader. Eisenhower was good at that. Planning is often more important than a plan. Eisenhower said that you have your battle plan, but that is compromised the minute you meet the enemy, because he doesn't cooperate with your plans. So then you have to think of another plan. So he says planning is essential, but plans, be careful. Regarding the project, Nehemiah wisely reduces a large problem. The wall is 2 miles long, into 42 small, more manageable sections. The simple organization of the plan is revealed in the repetition of the key phrases next to him or next to them and after him. You'll see that phrase over and over again in the chapter. Regarding the people, he secures their cooperation by thoughtful assignments. One, each family, regardless of occupation or social position, is to work on that section of the wall nearest to their house and upon which their security most depends, self-interest. And thus, too, each family is located where it is unnecessary to travel a long distance to work. Three, if attacked during construction, each family would not easily desert their posts and homes. And four, the whole family will be involved, even daughters, making for more workers and greater support for the work. Imagine the energy created by the unified activity of the whole community busy at work. Spiritual leaders understand the value of unity of purpose and what can be accomplished when it exists. For a negative example, see Genesis chapter 11, verse 6, the building of the Tower of Babel. He says, now, hey, they've got a unified purpose and a common language. Nothing's going to stop them. So he has to disrupt them. When dissension begins to infect the group, the leader must restore unity by reminding the people of their purpose and values. Nehemiah, as every wise leader should, publicly acknowledges those deserving of praise. He notes those who are distinguished for the earnestness of their work, verse 20, the quality of their work, verses 5, 11, 13, 19, 27, 30, the detail, again, the quality of their work, verse 3, and their personal faithfulness, verses 10, 23, 28, 29. But he also publicly records those whose behavior deserves public disgrace, like Eliashib, who appears indifferent to his responsibility, verses 20 and 21, as he is later to those of the temple in chapter 13. And those who refuse to cooperate, verse 5. Note, Nehemiah does not appear to have wasted time trying to motivate the recalcitrant. Leaders work most with those who have proven themselves to be faithful and fruitful. Very true, very true. Verse 10, next paragraph. The 10 gates listed here, 6 of which will need repair, an enemy assault will have centered on a gate, are in counterclockwise order, beginning at the north wall above the temple, then moving to the west wall, then to the south wall, and finally the east wall. A church is blessed when every person in it does the work they are spiritually gifted to do and have not disqualified themselves by moral or doctrinal failure. Like the assignments to work on the wall, the best protection against the evils of the world starts nearest the home. People in churches need both walls, boundaries, and gates to let those who are permitted in, those who are permitted. However, Nehemiah and Malachi will find that some of the real enemies are within the gates and walls, the sinful desires of God's people. That's what we're going to see next week in chapter 3. In what appears at first sight to be a very spiritually dry chapter. Are there any questions before we close? Okay. Nehemiah is a good spiritual leader. We need good spiritual leaders. Remember, leadership has three qualifications: character, competence, and compatibility. They have a godly character, they are qualified and have shown that they can do the job, and they are compatible. They embody the virtues of the group. Okay? And we said also, leaders do the four things. Leaders see what needs to be done. Leaders know how it can be done. Leaders are able to persuade others that what should be done can be done. And fourthly, leaders have the energy and the courage and the perseverance to keep at it until what needs to be done is done. Any questions? I can't wait for us to get to chapter 4 because that's where the sparks fly, and you may find that very interesting. That's where opposition truly comes. Opposition is always a test of the reality of your faith and an opportunity to grow. Father in heaven, thank you for the book of Nehemiah. What a man he is. Help us to be godly men and women who love your work, who love your people, who love you, and are willing to be faithful and diligent in doing that which blesses your people, which pleases you, and honors the Lord Jesus Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen.